Good evening. I'm Kilo 2, Romeo, India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel. He's Kilo 2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. Mel and Dick try to act like organizers, interlocutors, net control of the technical net. Main purpose of the technical net is education, a little bit of entertainment mixed in there from time to time. You'll hear a gathering of the clan of amateur radio operators in which they teach each other how to get more enjoyment and how all this stuff works. There's not a lot to learn about wireless technology, and the schools only do a mediocre job of teaching that. There's not many subjects to cover. If you really want to learn electronics, wireless electronics and radio electronics, become a ham radio operator, talk to ham radio operators. So that's what's going on with the technical net. Lots of brain power in that New York City area, including northern New Jersey, southern Connecticut, southern New York, southwestern Connecticut, and Long Island. So guys in that area, when they hear a subject that they have experience in, they chime in and tell us the benefit of their experience. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are 90-some-odd% of the time the subjects that you bring to the net as a question. Once in a while, Mel or Dick will have a canned program on a particular subject, but those are a little bit rare. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After 28 years of the net, we believe there are people listening. So you don't have to tell us that you're listening. We sort of accept that. We can save time by just collecting the people who do have a question. As you guys know from the previous from the previous month or two, there's a significant research program going on in the New York City area, headed up by Wesley N2XJN and John KC2WGB. So we've got them automatically signed in. They're acquiring test equipment at a ridiculously high rate, filling up their laboratories, and learning how to use all the stuff. So that could turn into quite a project. And therefore, Wesley and John are already signed in. For others who would like to sign in, put their name on the list, give me your call letters, your name, and as I said, the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. KQRIW listening.
KQ2O, John, no.
N2MB with no comments at this time.
KC2RFN, yes.
Six Dark Purple Zombies.
Okay, Doc
Joe, no.
Dark Purple Zombies, didn't give us a name, didn't give us a yes or a no. Doc Purple Zombies, was that a yes or a no?
Yes, I have a comment, Dick. I'm sorry. I'm driving and doing three things at once here.
Okay. Okay, we've got Alan, we've got Barry, we got John. Anyone else assigned? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes or no at this time. K2RIW in the tech net.
Dick, call K2KEY.
KQ2T. Joe, no.
Okay, we picked up Mel and Joe that time. Anyone else?
WA2WKB, George, no.
WS2M, Paul, with a yes.
Very fine. More than enough to get going. Let's see what John and Wesley have been doing. N2XJN, what new piece of test equipment. I better put that in plural. What new pieces of test equipment have you guys acquired? That's question number one. And a comment that I've got is that when I went to Google and Googled the word Fluke 5205A, I found some very nice data sheets that can tell me what that super high power, very heavy amplifier can do. So what new things have you acquired this week so far, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW in the tech net.
N2XJN, good evening, everybody. I start to assemble machining shop. That is for the reason because Eric and Glenn, they had a very good comment. You cannot take the measurement if you have a pile of stuff on the table and everything is moving. And that's why I didn't intend to repeat the experiment with the light bulb, what I did when I said that I was able to reach strange effect leading to over unity, but I concentrate myself on putting everything in order. Well, John would be able say something about the very ancient equipment that I have got, and also, Dick, I have sent you the email. 3 long pieces of wood with the straight wires on it, called coils, and all of the structure, and the question to actually everybody, Dick, Glenn, and Eric, was what is that, and what is it for? Let me drop. In the meantime, I have acquired late and a milling machine, so that will give me a help. Although milling machine is very much inconvenient because it's a part of the lathe, so you have to change the tables, it's a combo unit. But lathe is working very good, so I would be able to make a former for the coils and put everything in order. In the meantime, John was working on restoring some of the equipment, and he probably had a question about the frequency response, because he was using very short coils to measure. And so if you don't mind, let John to pick up. And I have a set of the questions, but if we don't have a time right now, I postpone it for later. John, pick up.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel. KG2WGB. Dick, if you did get a chance to look at the photographs, you're going to see a piece of real history that Wesley purchased. It's a board, very well made, with some wire on it and terminals. I remember using those in labs for calibrating shunts, but I wasn't sure if that was that particular device, if that was used for coils and shunts. But I was wondering if you had a chance to look at that, maybe you could comment on it.
Yes, John. I saw those pictures of the boards with the wire that zigzags back and forth between them. And at first I thought maybe it was a standard inductance, but now I don't think so. I think it's more likely a standard resistance. In other words, if it's precision nichrome-like wire of a known length, then it has a known number of ohms or milliohms, milliohms per inch or whatever. So I think it's possibly a standard resistor. And by way of tapping along the length, you can get precision resistance that are fractions of the overall resistance. That's a guess, but I don't know for sure. It's kind of unusual to wind an inductor as a zigzag. Normally, inductors are wound as a solenoid coil, or possibly a toroidal coil. But to zigzag it back and forth like that, I'm having trouble believing that the standard inductor, although it possibly is. Just that the formulas I'm familiar with that try to predict inductance, knowing the diameter of the turns, the number of turns, the length of the coil, and so on, it doesn't fit any of those normal criteria.
Did you look at these 2 tablets that came with it?
Yes, I know that there's a whole bunch of calibration tablets or spreadsheets that go with it. Not quite sure what that all is. I also saw pictures of this, I believe, German-made lathe-like machine, milling machine, lathe-like machine. And that looks like it's a very well-made piece of machinery, which I presume you two guys have acquired. Back to you, John. HURIW in the TechNet.
Oh, that stuff is on the board, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel. Give us your words on that. What is that stuff on the board, and did you see the picture?
Yeah, I saw that in a lab many years ago, when Wheatstone
bridges were very popular. They had the number of the ones. They had a lot of fancy ones, you know, with those beautiful Bakelite panels and the controls on it. And then they had these, I guess they were used mostly for classroom demonstrations and all. It was sort of with boards with a slider on them. And that was part, in other words, to demonstrate the operation of a Wheatstone bridge, Dick. I remember that very distinctly, over.
One more comment. If you look at the tablet that came with it, it should explain, because the wire that is over there is the straight wire. On one tail, there are three pieces of wood. Two pieces are alike, and one is different. One has only one wire, and the meter ruler, if I use the proper word, John?
Yeah, it looks to me like it's quite possibly a proportional resistor, depending on where along the meter ruler you make contact. But I didn't see a contacting device. How back to you, John. Wait for the beep.
Yes, Dick, exactly what Mel said. I remember using those in the lab for calibrating shunts, where we would make a 50 milligold shunt and you would file pieces off of it and compare it to the setting of that board for all of the shunts that you made. That's the only thing I could come up with when I saw that, because those are things that we did use. But like Mel said, that was many years ago. But very interesting, and he wanted to hang it on the wall for an artifact.
Did you see any mechanism by which you could make contact at intermediate places between the input connector and the output connector as the wire zigzags back and forth around those round bobbins at each end? And then the wire itself looked to me like it was recessed below the surface of the wood, mounted inside a slot. I wonder if there was a mechanism by which you could reach in there into those slots and something, I'd slide a contact along there in order to look for a particular intermediate resistance. Did you see any evidence of something like that, John? Go ahead.
No, Dick, they're not recessed in the board. They're held flat on the board, and you just slide a probe along them. There was no fixed slider that I've ever seen on those boards. You just located two points on there and made that as a reference to the meter stick.
Now, if it is a system like a potentiometer where you put a known precision voltage across the end of this long piece of wire zigzag back and forth on the board, and then you make probing contacts at intermediate positions looking for a specific voltage, that would make a lot of sense to me. However, if you were looking for a specific resistance on the slider, I see a little bit of a problem, because the contact resistance then becomes a bit of a problem. Somewhat like the problem that is solved with a four-terminal resistor, a so-called Kelvin connection. If I've got a precision resistor, and you've got two great big contacts to that resistor, the contact resistance is something you've got to worry about. However, if I put a known amount of current through that precision resistor, and then close by I've got two other contacts where no current flows, I only look for voltage drop. Now I can make milliohms and maybe microohms of resistance measurement independent of contact resistance, because of the constant current generator feeding the precision resistor. I'm making a guess that that may have been some of the principle of operation of this thing. The main contact on the end, they look to you like it was a way of making more than one contact simultaneously, like a total of four contacts as a possibility, as opposed to only two. Back to you, John.
Apparently, the only thing I've seen, the wires are sort of in a V fashion. They leave one terminal, go out, loop around a second terminal, and then come back, so that you can pick an individual wire which would have two runs out of the four runs. I think there's 10 wires altogether, if I remember correctly. But now, if you read, some of the nomenclature is confusing because it's for coil use. And that's what confused me. I know originally when we made shunts for small devices, we could make them out of coil wire. And you would wind the coil up on one set of terminals and then compare the length of the wire on the other slide wires and compare the resistance. That's the only other way I could see that thing being used, but the wires are not recessed, they're just flat on the board. And what gets me is there's no sliding contact. That's confusing.
And also the resistance, if there is a resistance, you have on the Central Scientific Company that tablet that is attached there. It says 0.985, and that's for the terminal 1. 1957 for terminal 2. 2985 for terminal 3. Now, each one of the terminals is the grounded. John, can you explain that?
Notice that those numbers are extremely close to 1 ohm, 2 ohms, and 3 ohms, and they're just a very small percentage away from that. Over to you, John.
Yes, I noticed that. Also, that device was manufactured for Leeds and Northrop, I believe. And Wesley, I didn't understand your question.
This banana kind of end contact, they are rounded, and the wire is around them, if you can describe that.
Yes, Dick, those banana plugs, as he's calling them, those contacts, they have a land on the bottom, sort of like a washer, which is part of the banana jack itself, that has a threaded rod going from the banana through the board to a nut on the bottom. The wire is only compressed between the wood and the land of the banana jack. That's how the contact is made. And that wire is either silver or nichrome. I'm not sure which it is.
There's a way you could find out pretty fast. Nichrome has a resistivity which is almost 100 times higher than silver. As such, by knowing the diameter of the wire, which you can measure with the calipers, and knowing the length of the wire in meters or feet, and going to a wire cable.
24 gauge.
Okay, so 24 gauge, knowing the length, and comparing it in ohms per foot of copper.
48 inches.
Okay, and 48 inches. But what I'm getting at is the number of ohms per foot. If it was copper, the tables we know about that are in the Radio Amateur Handbook will tell you right away how many ohms you should get. And if the number of ohms you're getting is something close to 50 or 100 times higher, then most likely it is nichrome wire. I'll back to you for any comments on that, John.
The only odd thing I notice is it looks like silver because it's tarnished. And I recommended that Wesley try some silver polish on one little tiny spot and rub it and see if it cleans up. If it's nichrome, it won't clean up.
Is there a possibility it's got silver-plated ends, but the length of the wire is some other substance? Or is the silver plating that you're seeing constant along the length of the wires? Over to you, John.
Yes, it has the look of sterling silver to me, and it seems to be the whole length.
That is a bit of a mystery. Any evidence anywhere as to the year of manufacture?
Yes. What it says on one table on the right-hand side says established in 1889. That was for the company that was established, Central Scientific Company. But there is a note on the right-hand side of the barroom, it's pencil. And that note says 12-9-30. 12-9-1930, I believe. It probably is, because it's not printed, it's just the handwriting. So might be when this device was delivered to the school or to whatever entity. I don't know. Thank you.
Yeah, with the numbers like that, you got to worry a little bit about them. Many Europeans will write down the date as year, month, day. We make a weird mixture here. The way we write down date is month, day, year. And the rest of the world doesn't quite understand. So the 30 at the 1930. The 12 in the beginning could either be the 12th month or the year 1912. In either case, it's at least 40 years old and maybe 48 years old or 58 years old. Interesting. I've got the mathematics wrong here. Let's see, if it's 1912, it would be 98 years old. How about that? So it's you got a piece of history there. And I'm going to make a guess that it is where those number of ohms, 0.985 and 1.957 and 2.985, it looks to me like a precision resistor setup with possibility of making contact at intermediate points to get a calibrated resistance in between. And the exact amount of resistance, exact amount of voltage, those things are needed when it comes to running things like thermocouples and thermocouple sensing devices for making precision measurements of temperature. I'm going to move along, and we're going to come back. I think the next person who signed in was Alan, and Alan was doing some interesting experiments on antennas the last time we heard. And if I know Alan, he's probably constructed at least one more since then. KC2, RFN, K2RIW in the second hand. You got it, Alan.
Yeah, one more thing, Dick, KC2RIW.
Yeah, take him out. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, if it was right from the 1890s and all, I think when he said for moving coil, you got to remember those meters at that time were galvanometers. So I think that could be shunt for galvanometers, Dick, over.
Yeah, once you know the exact number of ohms of your meter movement, and you know it's a 1 milliampere full scale, then by a relatively simple calculation, if you know the number of milliohms or ohms of shunt you're putting across the meter, you can convert your 1 milliamp meter movement, for instance, into a 500 milliampere, a 500 ampere, and so on, just by putting the right kind of shunt across it. The average guy runs into a real problem. He wants to measure the number of ohms of his meter movement, and when he goes to the low number of ohm scale on his volt ohm milliammeter, it puts an amount of current to the meter that will peg the needle, maybe even break it. So making the low number of ohms of measurement without putting a lot of current through something, there's a way of doing it. It's called the half voltage technique, where you take a relatively high voltage power supply, a relatively high resistor, and you set it up in such a way that this nearly constant current generator that I just mentioned, high voltage, high resistor, is very close to a constant current generator. You set that up so you get full-scale deflection, 1 milliampere, for instance. Then you start putting resistors across the meter movement until it comes down to half-scale deflection, half a milliampere. Then you know for a fact that the shunt that you just put across the meter and the meter movement themselves are equal to each other, as long as you've got a high enough fidelity in the constant current characteristic of your constant current generator. So there are crafty ways of measuring the meter movement resistance without damaging it. Okay, Alan, go right ahead. KC2RFN. What kind of antennas did you build this week? K2RIW. You got it, Alan.
Yeah, KC2RFN in the net. Right, last week I talked about I put up a vertical dipole, and I compared it to my $250 Gap Titan ground-mounted antenna. And I found out that the dipole performed better than the Gap by four. This weekend I put up a fully horizontal dipole up in the trees and up against my house. I think that one's GR5V, it's 50 feet, it's a junior, the 52-foot antenna. I put that up, and that outperformed the Gap antenna by far, and also outperformed the vertical antenna, the vertical dipole. And it was one interesting thing that I found that I wanted to ask you about, because it's a little counterintuitive. Let me just drop. I was able to hook in the new horizontal dipole into antenna 1 of my HF rig, and I put in the Gap Titan vertical into the second antenna input. I was able to compare them pretty easily. And what I found is when I had the expensive Gap Titan on, And I was just listening to background with nobody in particular on frequency. I heard a lot of noise. The noise floor was much higher. But when I switched over to the horizontal, the noise floor dropped by at least 2S units. And then, of course, when I did get somebody on frequency, there was no comparison. The GR5V Junior horizontal dipole really outperformed the vertical by 2, sometimes 3S units when I was comparing between the two of them. And this was on 20, 40, and even 80. So I didn't understand why I would hear more noise on the vertical, on the gap Titan, when the signal itself didn't sound as good. I mean, it seems to me like it's more sensitive, but it's not picking up the signals as well when there's a real transmission on the line. So I couldn't understand that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, fascinating set of questions you got there, Alan. First of all, the antenna you talked about most recently, I'm going to make sure I got, I didn't have my speech processor turned on. I wonder if my voice sounded so mushy. The G5RV, made by Lou Varney, who's now at Silent Key, a very famous dipole-like multi-band antenna, G5RV. That is usually set up as a horizontal antenna. Much man-made noise favors vertical. So when it comes to power line noise and things like that, vertical polarization, reception of it will be louder. One of the very interesting experiments you can do, Alan, I think you own an oscilloscope, and you can set your oscilloscope up in such a way that it is synchronized to the 60 cycle line. Most scopes, let me drop.
Late check-in.
Okay, what's the call letters of the late check-in? Give me your call letters and name, sir. And don't give me a yes or a no as to whether or not you have a question. Go ahead. KB2, Victor, Bravo, November. Please tell me your name and give me a yes or a no as to whether or not you have a question or a comment.
No, my name is Freddie.
And Freddie, should I put you on the list for somebody who does have a question or a comment? Over to you, Freddie.
No question.
Okay, Freddie, and maybe after you hear what all we're discussing, maybe you'll come up with a question. And by the way, Freddie, your audio is quite low. It could be a little bit louder. Now, as I was starting to say, most oscilloscopes will have a synchronization setting, which is called line sync, where it uses the 60-cycle line as a synchronization, the 60-cycle power coming from Con Ed or Loco. And you can confirm that you've got it set up correctly by simply touching the scope probe with your finger and getting some kind of a ratty-looking single sine wave across the screen when you set up the horizontal sweep and the vertical gain correctly. Then if you connect that to the audio output of your receiver, you will immediately find out whether or not the noise you're hearing is related to your local power. If the noise you see comes in bursts, and those bursts sit still with reference to a line sync oscilloscope, that'll give you a clue. Even if at worst the noise you get is thoroughly random and it doesn't follow the line syncing on your oscilloscope, another possible explanation is that Mother Nature's ionosphere, with its Faraday rotation, from time to time, day, night, high, low, sunspot cycle, whatever, will favor certain polarizations. So the possibility exists that the vertical polarization represents an ionospheric reflection coming from some portion of the world where, even though there may not be a radio amateur there, there's an awful lot of atmospheric noise, like a whole set of thunderstorms going on in that area. So some of what you're seeing is polarization related, some of it's altitude of antenna related, which is a big function on what pattern you get. Let me drop.
Give you a comment on that, Dick.
Yeah, I'll be sending it over to Mel in a minute. As you adjust the antenna at various altitudes above the ground, you think you've got an antenna above ground. Well, that's not what Mother Nature sees. As far as HF frequencies are concerned, the Earth in your backyard, Alan, is nearly a mirror. It's a slightly sloppy mirror, but it's nearly a mirror. So you've got a real antenna above the ground. You have a mirror image of that antenna below ground. if it's a horizontally polarized antenna, because you get a phase reversal of 180 degrees on reflection from the ground for a horizontally polarized signal. You really have a real antenna above the ground, a mirror image of one below the ground, that are out of phase with each other. And that gives you a predictable elevation pattern all the way around that antenna. By comparison, the vertically polarized antenna also has a mirror image, but with vertical polarization, you don't get a phase reversal. So the above-ground antenna, the mirror image below ground, are in phase with each other. So you get very different antenna patterns around your antenna, if you could see it as a three-dimensional thing, depending on horizontal or vertical, and depending on altitude above the ground. When that horizontal antenna gets higher above the ground, those vertical lobes of the elevation pattern squeeze together. There's more of them, and the lowest one moves closer to the ground as you raise the antenna at a higher altitude. So as you can tell, there's quite a number of variables going on here. And which ones they are, by way of your oscilloscope, you'll get a little bit of a clue as to whether or not it's local power line noise as one of the factors. Local power line noise tends to be louder vertical than horizontal. K2KEY, bet you've done a lot of these experiments, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, one of the secrets of operating on HF to work DX, what I do, for instance, is I rotate the beam around, and the direction that the noise peak is the band opening sometimes follows the gray line. But I find that's usually very consistent. I can hear that background noise, and if I move it, when I stop moving the beam around, when I peak that background noise, that usually I find there are stations, either down in South America or out to the Middle East, Far East, or whatever. But it seems to follow that. You hear that background noise, and when it peaks, that's the direction that the band is your open loop deck over.
Fascinating. So, we don't have the whole answer. We've got a bunch of clues. We've got a bunch of guesses, Alan. And by way of the experiment you're going to be doing, you're going to be able to pin down a little bit more. Propagation is a fun thing. Not a simple subject. And you're slowly getting into it. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, when I compared, that vertical, gap vertical to the, G5RV held vertically, the G5RV performs so much better that I wonder if it's if I should just get rid of the gap Titan, because it performs so much better. I mean, the vertical is 50 feet up in the trees, and it's coming almost totally straight down. But my gap Titan is a bit of a monster, and that's only mounted about 6 feet off the ground. I don't know if that's making a difference or not. Would it matter if I raised it, let's say, 10 feet?
I think you're asking if you raise the gap Titan 10 feet, would you get a difference? The answer is yes. As you raise an antenna above the ground, the main factor you care about is number of wavelengths that you've moved it. Obviously, the change you'll get on 10 meters, where the wavelength is much shorter, you'll get a much faster change in elevation pattern as you raise the antenna above ground. You'll get a much bigger change on 10 meters than you will on the lower frequencies. So it's number of wavelengths that determines the elevation pattern, not feet. You'd be amazed how many times people fall into that trap of saying, I raised my antenna 20 feet, therefore all my lobes have moved together X number of degrees. You can talk about how much the lobes have moved on each one of the individual bands, and they're not all the same. It's a function of wavelengths. And just to give you an example, if I moved an antenna that was foolishly directly above the ground by a couple of inches, which means that my elevation pattern would be a lobe that's straight up and almost nothing to the horizon. If I now raise the antenna so it's one wavelength above the ground, bear in mind now you've got one antenna, one wavelength above ground, the mirror image is a wavelength below ground, you've got two wavelengths of separation between the two antennas, and if I was smart enough, I could give you a quick answer as to what the first elevation angle would be for that. I'm going to have to go make myself a diagram and give you an answer on that one, but once you understand the way sines and cosines add together, it's a fairly easy situation to calculate where is that elevation pattern. There's also some very nice information on this subject in the earlier chapters of the AROL antenna book, among other books. So I wonder if anyone has any further questions or comments on what Alan is experimenting with. If you've got some in your experience you want to add at this time, please give me your call.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So give me your call letters if you want to add something to the height versus horizontal and vertical experiments that Alan is doing right now. You've got some experience? Give us your call letters right now.
KG2T with a question.
KG2T recognized. Anyone else? KG2T, go right ahead.
The only question I have to Alan and to the group also is, if I believe that the antenna is referring to the vertical antenna, requires ground radials. Now, I don't know whether those radials would have an effect on receiving. I know that definitely would have an effect on a transmitted signal. But I'm wondering if he had ground radials in an antenna, whether his received signal would be improved. Take over.
John, good question and comment, Joe. And by the way, the soil conductivity is so high in New Hyde Park, where Joe lives, you don't have to worry about ground plane radials. That's a joke. Without a doubt. As you add more and more ground plane radials, Lee in the Pacific, W2CMI, I think is his call letters. He had a whole series of articles in Ham Radio Magazine about electrically small antennas. And he did a whole series of experiments with various kinds of ferrite balance for doing impedance matching, and a bunch of experiments for adding more and more ground plane radials. As you add more and more ground plane radials around your vertically polarized quarter wave-like antenna, the efficiency of the antenna increases continuously until you get to something like 30 or so radials, and then it's a law of diminishing returns beyond that. If I put a very small number of radios, like 3 instead of 30, the antenna maybe will have, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 50% efficiency as opposed to 100% efficiency with 30 radios. 50% versus 100% when it comes to transmitting, and therefore I'm getting an equivalent of 100 watts transmitted versus 150 watts transmitted, to the average guy that sounds like a huge difference. And to some people it is. Let me drop. But when you come back to the hard rules by which your receiver really works, your receiver, just like your hearing system and your visual system, almost everything in nature works in a logarithmic manner. Decibels. 50% efficiency versus 100% efficiency is only 3 decibels of difference. So when it comes to the amount of signal strength of noise coming from some particular direction where his antenna favors that direction and that elevation, and I go from a whole lot of radials to very little radials, that's going to make a 3 dB difference, a half S unit. Alan is reporting a much bigger difference than that. So it's a factor, Joe, but I think it's a minor factor. I wonder if you see where I'm going on that one. KG2T, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, good explanation. I don't have anything else to add to it, but I was curious, I was wondering, if that would have helped maybe a situation. I mean, there's a difference between a vertical antenna and a dipole. Vertical antenna is always more susceptible to noise, not only because of its pattern, but it's also a 360-degree, pickup area as compared to a dipole. Thanks, Dick. I don't have any more. KG2T, thank you.
Want to comment on the
Titan? Yeah, before we go over to Mel's comment, yes, the dipole has got a pattern that favors the two broadside directions, whereas the vertical favors all 360 degrees. And if I choose the right elevation pattern, elevation angle by which I make the assessment of total power received or transmitted, and I walk around the antenna with this apparatus, the dipole pattern is a little bit stronger in some directions than the vertical, and a hell of a lot weaker in some directions. The difference between the two is only a couple of dB again, Joe. It's a factor, but it's not a major factor. Mel, go right ahead. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. First of all, the Titan is not what you are envisioning, the regular vertical. We discussed it, remember, once in detail. They call it a gap because it is, has this elevated feed point. The counterpoise is a type of counterpoise that comes with the antenna. You can't alter it. If you do, the doggone thing just doesn't work really. It's too much to say. At least we tried that, putting a different type of counterpoise on it, and to make conditions worse with the gap. I've had a lot of experience with it. My friend had one, so we've had it up and down a number of times. And if you remember, Dick, it uses this elevated feed with the zigzag matching up network up there and these transition rods and all. As to height above ground, we have done some minor experiments with it. What is its optimum height? You talk the gap and they give you several different answers. And most of the time they say just put it up so that the counterpoise, you know, clears enough of the ground so nobody walks into it. And in the instance that we've had this gap working, testing it, I don't know if I dropped it. In the instances that we've tested this gap against other antennas, we have found that it's strange. For instance, it outperformed a 40-meter dipole, but a dipole on 20 meters outperformed it. 15 meters, it was the equal of a 15-meter dipole. On 80 meters, well, it seems to be funny. At times, it seems to be as good as a dipole on 80, and other times, nowhere like anything that you would want to bother with. So, is the condition? Yes, has part to do with it. Well, sorry. Also happens to be, you know, frequency situation with that tightness. It's a little bit off the beaten path of what you would really. It's a thing off the, a little bit off the beaten path, as I said, of vertical. So the results are very variable with it, Dick. Over.
I've got two questions for you, Mel. When you were doing those experiments of Titan versus dipole, roughly what was the altitude of the dipole? I'm going to guess something like 30 feet, but you can correct me on that one, because I think that would make some difference in the way you make the measurement comparisons. Second of all, I know we've discussed the Titan once before, but I'm a little bit on the forgetful side. Would you consider the Titan closer to being a half-wave radiator on some of those bands versus a quarter-wave radiator? And when it comes to the number of ground plane radials required, a half-wave radiator almost needs no ground plane radials at all for a bunch of complicated reasons. The main one is that the base impedance is closer to 1,500 ohms as opposed to a quarter-wave. The base impedance is more like 20 ohms, and that makes a huge difference in the number of ground plane radials required. So roughly the altitude of the dipole, and would you consider Titan closer to half wave as opposed to quarter wave on most of those bands? What do you think, Mel? Go ahead.
No, it's hard to say. You got to look at the antenna. And if you remember, we discussed verticals in detail. And we came up with a number of different verticals that you remember that we were talking about, that some strange, you know, configuration seems vertical, seems to fall into that category. But how would I really say the Titan, what is it? I don't know, because of the system that they use. You know, they got this split about halfway up or so, well, maybe a little higher than halfway up, they got this split. And they put inside this thing a zigzag cable, and then outside, supposedly to match it, they hang these things called the transition rods, different length rods around the Titan antenna. And below that, there's these four arms that protrude off the bottom of the antenna, and there's a wire wrapped around it. I call it the ground toys, the ground, what the heck, they have a name for it, I don't remember how they described it, but that's basic. If you look back, you'll see we did a lot of discussion on how does antenna work, and its merits and demerits, over.
Yeah, that ground counterpoise thing with the four arms coming out and the circle around it, the recommended procedure is to put that roughly how far above the ground? Now, Mel, go ahead.
According to my discussion with GAP, because we did run into several issues with them, when my friend bought that thing, like I say, it's not a cheap antenna, and so I spoke to them on the phone, and seems like the consensus was that this is a great antenna for people who need a, as they say, a small footprint. And the person I talked to, he said, just put it high enough so that nobody walks into that that counterpoint, or whatever you like to call it, Dick, over.
And the word counterpoise, I'm going to give you guys a couple of words on this one. And just to give you a very basic piece of physics you've heard a few times before, make-believe Arnold Schwarzenegger weighs 200 pounds. He's floating freely in the cargo bay of the space shuttle while it's in orbit. And Arnold is holding on to a 200-pound barbell, and he's a 200-pound man, and he's floating in free space. Newton's second law, action and reaction, dictates that when he pushes the barbell to the north at 1 meter per second, his body will move 1 meter per second to the south. Action and reaction equal to each other, because I've set up the masses equal to each other. By the same token, when you pump current into an antenna, your current generating device, your transmitter, has to push against something. Let me drop. In the case of a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a dipole, at one instant of time, you're pumping charge into the right-hand side of the dipole. At the same time, you're taking it out of the left-hand side. You could say you're forcing electrons to go into the right-hand side, and you're taking them out of the left-hand side. Half a cycle later, you're doing the opposite. So the dipole, with a proper kind of a balancing device, is a thoroughly balanced antenna, and everything stays neutral as far as Earth is concerned. In the case of a quarter-wave ground plane, where you want to pump current into that quarter-wave high vertical radiator, you've got to push against something. The thing you push against, we call it the counterpoise, the ground plane radial system. And so you want that to be at least as substantial, if not more, than the vertical radiator for it to work right. Because a dipole being a thoroughly balanced antenna, I could have my dipole in free space. I could put a sheet of metal right down the center of the dipole, where it's at right angles to the dipole. I've got a sheet of metal right down the middle. In other words, the right-hand side looks like a quarter-wave ground plane to the sheet of metal. The left-hand side of the dipole looks like a quarter-wave ground plane to the sheet of metal. At one instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole is positive. The left-hand side is negative. There's a neutral plane right where the sheet of metal is. As such, putting the sheet of metal there does nothing to the impedance or the pattern of the antenna. Of course, that sounds crazy. Take my word for it. It's 98% true. Putting the sheet of metal there, normal to the dipole, does nothing. But once you've got the sheet of metal, and you realize it does nothing when the dipole is fed in the normal manner, I could then decide to throw away the left-hand side of the dipole, feed only the right-hand side with the sheet of metal, rotate the whole thing 90 degrees, and you and I call that a vertical ground plane, a vertical radiated ground plane type antenna. But now you need that great big sheet of metal. It's got to push against something. So the counterpoise, the ground plane radial
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That counterpoise and the ground plane radial system and how much current you pump into it is a big function of what impedance the antenna presents at the point you're feeding it. A quarter wave vertical has a base impedance something like 20 ohms. So you pour 100 watts into that, and you're putting a substantial number of amperes into it, and you have to put those amperes in there with reference for something. Arnold said a push against something, if you know what I mean. Whereas if I made the radiator a half wave long instead of a quarter wave long, now the impedance that I'm feeding is something closer to 1,500 ohms. The same 100 watts is now launching a lot higher voltage, but a much, much smaller current. Therefore, you can almost get away with almost nothing on the ground plane radials. There are a substantial number of amateurs who have set up a half-wave radiator on the veranda of their apartment, let's say the 15th floor of a building, using nothing as the counterpoise but the metal railing, the safety railing, that's on the balcony. And that works like a beautiful antenna if it's a half-wave radiator. You do the same thing with a quarter-wave radiator, and you'll have much degraded performance. So more to it than first meets the eye. Interesting set of experiments you're doing here, Alan. I hope you have an oscilloscope, and I'm looking forward to what you're going to find when you do line syncing and looking at that noise that you're seeing. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2RFN. Yeah, I can do that. I have an oscilloscope. Is it as simple as just throwing the probes across the speaker? Is that the output, the audio output? Is that acceptable for me to look on the scope with?
Absolutely. As long as the scope is line sunk, and you said probes, you only need one probe. On the assumption now that your loudspeaker has one lead grounded. If not, you're going to use the two probes, A minus B function. And maybe your loudspeaker will tolerate one lead being grounded by the oscilloscope, ground lead versus the hot probe. But when you touch the oscilloscope probe with your finger, you should see one single sine wave across the screen. And you'll recognize the phasing and the syncing and the sync sensitivity and so on. You'll make that sit still. And it's going to be a slightly sloppy sine wave because when your finger picks up line noise from your QTH, it's always going to be picking up a lot of other kinds of noises. But that's the way to confirm that the scope is synchronized to 60 cycles. Then you put that scope probe across the loudspeaker, and if the noise that you see comes in bursts that sits still on that screen, it'll give you a strong clue as to whether or not it is locally generated arcing and sparking of a high voltage insulator or your pole pig transformer or your next door neighbor's fish tank heater or whatever. If the noise that you see on the oscilloscope is thoroughly uniform, random but uniform across the screen, then you know it's not, most likely not locally generated. That'll give you a strong clue. And if you do see this burst of noise that synchronizes with the 60 cycle line, then the fact that you get a lot louder noise vertical versus horizontal, the simple explanation is that a vertical antenna is more sensitive to the local noise. The noise that's on your power line, because the power line is horizontal, but the noise is an extremely low frequency, 60 cycles. Therefore, it is, although the piece of wire that it's on, the power line is horizontal, that noise is primarily vertically polarized. Because with that long a wavelength, you could say,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You could say that the left-hand side of the wire at the beginning of your block and the right-hand side of your wire at the end of the block, 60 cycle-wise, are in phase with each other. So at that instant of time, the whole piece of wire goes positive, if you know what I mean. And when you picture what that's doing to your local environment, that is primarily a vertically polarized E-field created by that wire, even though the wire itself is horizontally polarized. If you are now worried about the amount of noise on that wire at, say, for instance, 15 meters, the answer is going to be different. Because now the wires, portions of the wire are starting to become more comparable to wavelength. I know I didn't give a good explanation of that, but maybe you see some of the principle of that. Now back to you, Alan.
Oh, no, I got it. That's no problem. I'll do that. You put a lot of emphasis on symmetricality of the signal, whether it's vertical or horizontal, symmetricality of the antenna, be it the other side of a dipole or a counterpoise. But I was wondering if it was possible on my property. I have a run between trees that could go about 90 feet. The problem is I wouldn't ask my neighbors to suffer the T-looking, you know, wire system over my house. But if I can have an N-fed wire, then I can run one wire into a tree, run the other wire into the other tree across the top of my house, and then just run the line down the tree into the shack. That, I think, would be a lot more acceptable to my neighbors. And I think I can get about a 90-foot run on that. That's the longest straight run I can get, almost a diagonal across my property. Is there a way to work with a wire like that, and would it allow me to get into the 80 meters and maybe even 160 meters realistically with a tuner?
N2 opposite.
I heard N2, and then you dropped out. We'll come back to you in a minute. Absolutely. If you're smart enough, Alan, the shortest piece of property you've got, with the right kind of an antenna tuner that has enough hair in its chest, enough tunable range, can get you on 160 meters, 80 meters, and whatever. I will admit that if your antenna is physically end-to-end very short compared to 80 meters, and if its altitude above the ground is very short in wavelength compared to 80 meters, your total radiation efficiency and the number of DX contacts you're going to make is going to be limited. But can you make your piece of property into a good standing wave ratio antenna on 80 meters with a good antenna tuner? Absolutely. And these various ways you're talking about running the wires up the tree and then over and then another one over the house, go right ahead and do those experiments. Real fun experiments. Wire is inexpensive. Your neighbors don't see wire. You're soon going to discover that no matter how much wire you've got in the air, it ain't enough. Every new one you add, some hour of some day on some band is going to give you an advantage, and you're going to be glad you got it. Go for it. So, and whether or not your antenna tuner covers that particular crazy impedance, let me drop. Bear in mind that every antenna tuner, whether it be a Pi type, an L type, a Pi L, or whatever, a T type, there's various kinds of antenna tuners schematically, various brand names with various tuning ranges. If your manufacturer was thorough enough, he would give you a Smith chart and he would say that this antenna tuner covers that area of the Smith chart that we have covered in, that we have colored in. It'd be nice to know, you know, how much of the area of the Smith chart of all possible impedances does your antenna tuner accommodate. Almost every antenna tuner at some particular phase angle has more capability than at some other. So even if your antenna tuner does appear to run out of range the first time you add it to your, connect it to your particular antenna, just add another eighth wave, quarter wave, half wave of transmission line between the output of your antenna tuner and your new antenna. What you're doing when you add that extra length of transmission line is you're taking the true impedance of your antenna, which at this frequency is a dot somewhere on that Smith chart. And now you could connect your compass with the sharp point at the center of the Smith chart and the pencil on that dot, and as you add a eighth wave of cable, you go a quarter of the, you go 90 degrees on the Smith chart. Add a quarter wave of cable, you go 180 degrees on the Smith chart. In other words, by adding a length of cable, you are moving that dot by way of that compass to some other location on the Smith chart with the exact same radius from the center. If you're adding the same impedance of line, you're not changing the standing wave ratio. You're changing the phase angle of that particular standing wave ratio. You rotate it to some other portion of the chart where, if you're a little bit lucky, you'll now come back into range of your antenna tuner. You use these tricks on even your inexpensive antenna tuner. You can make almost any antenna you've got fly. And that's before you start doing the elaborate things of adding stubs and SIP
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
That's before you start doing anything elaborate by adding stubs and series capacitors and shunt inductors and whatever to correct the impedance. There's a zillion ways to do it. Go do it. You're going to have fun. And every one of these experiments are not thoroughly predictable. Your particular environment has got local trees, houses, downspouts, antenna tuning, downspouts for the rain gutters and so on, local wiring in the houses, water towers across the street, a hill down the block and so on. Every one of our environments is different, and so you can never thoroughly predict what the antenna is going to do until you go run the experiment. There was another person trying to sign in. Who was that? Give me your call letters and your name. K2RIW and the TechNet.